Something as random as a display of cork-soled sandals in a store window could bring her to mind. "Who's Dini?" Abra asked. Then she blinked rapidly and drew back a little as if Dan had suddenly flapped a hand in front of her eyes. "Oops, not supposed to go there, I guess. Sorry." "It's okay," he said. "Let's go back to your hat woman. When you saw her later, in your window, that wasn't the same?"
"No, I'm not even sure that was a shining. I think it was a remembering from when I saw her hurting the boy."
"So she didn't see you then either. She's never seen you." If the woman was as dangerous as Abra believed, this was important.
"No, I'm sure she hasn't. But she wants to." She looked at him, her eyes wide, her mouth trembling again. "When the turntable thing happened, she was thinking mirror. She wanted me to look at myself. She wanted to use my eyes to see me."
"What did she see through your eyes? Could she find you that way?" Abra thought it over carefully. At last she said,
"I was looking out my window when it happened. All I can see from there is the street and the mountains, of course, but there are lots of mountains in America, right?"
"Right." Could the woman in the hat match the mountains she'd seen through Abra's eyes to a photo if she did an exhaustive computer search? Like so much else in this business, there was just no way to be sure.
"Why did they kill him, Dan? Why did they kill the baseball boy?"
He thought he knew, and he would have hidden it from her if he could. But even this short meeting was enough to tell him he would never have that sort of relationship with Abra Rafaela Stone. Recovering alcoholics strove for complete honesty in all our affairs, but rarely achieved it. He and Abra could not avoid it. "Food."
She stared at him aghast. "They ate his shining?"
"I think so."
"They're vampires."
Then aloud,
"Like in Twilight?"
"Not like them," Dan said. "And for God's sake, Abra, I'm only guessing." The library door opened. Dan looked around, afraid it might be the overly curious Yvonne Stroud, but it was a boy-girl couple that only had eyes for each other. He turned back to Abra.
"We have to wrap this up." "I know."
She raised a hand, rubbed at her lips, realized what she was doing, and put it back in her lap.
"But I have so many questions. There's so much I want to know. It would take hours."
"Which we don't have. You're sure it was a Sam's?"
"Huh?"
"She was in a Sam's supermarket."
"Oh, yes.
I know the chain. I've even shopped in one or two, but not around here."
She grinned. "Course not, Uncle Dan. There aren't any. They're all out west. I went on Google for that, too."
The grin faded.
"There are hundreds of them, all the way from Nebraska to California."
"I need to think about this some more, and so do you. You can stay in touch with me by email if it's important, but it would be better if we just..." He tapped his forehead. "Zip, zip, you know?"
"Yes," she said, and smiled. "The only good part of this is having a friend who knows how to zip, zip, and what it's like."
"Can you use the blackboard?"
"Sure, it's pretty easy."
"You need to keep one thing in mind, one above all others. The hat woman probably doesn't know how to find you, but she knows you're out there someplace." She had grown very still. He reached for her thoughts, but Abra was guarding them. "Can you set a burglar alarm in your mind, so that if she's someplace near, either mentally or in person, you'll know?"
"You think she's going to come for me, don't you?"
"She might try. Two reasons. First, just because you know she exists."
"And her friends," Abra whispered. "She has lots of friends."
"With flashlights."
"What's the other reason?"
And before he could reply,
"Because I'd be good to eat. Like the baseball boy was good to eat. Right?"
There was no point denying it. To Abra, his forehead was a window. "Can you set an alarm? A proximity alarm? That's..."
"I know what proximity means. I don't know. But I'll try."
He knew what she was going to say next before she said it, and there was no mind reading involved. She was only a child, after all. This time, when she took his hand, he didn't pull away.
Promise. You won't let her get me, Dan. Promise.
He did, because she was a kid and needed comforting. But of course, there was only one way to keep such a promise, and that was to make the threat go away. He thought it again. Abra, the trouble you're getting me into. And she said it again, but this time not out loud.
Sorry.
Not your fault, kid. You didn't
ask for this
any more than I did. Go on in with your books. I have to get back to Fraser. I'm on shift tonight.
Okay. But we're friends, right?
Totally friends.
I'm glad.
And I bet you'll like the fixer. I think you'll get it, because you've fixed a few things in your time, haven't you?
Pretty dimples deepened the corners of her mouth. You'd know.
Oh, believe me, Dan said. He watched her start up the steps, then pause and come back.
I don't know who the woman in the hat is, but I know one of her friends. His name is Barry the Chunk, or something like that. I bet wherever she is, Barry the Chunk is someplace close, and I could find him if I had the baseball boy's glove.
She looked at him, a steady, level glance from those beautiful blue eyes.
I'd know, because for a little while, Barry the Chunk was wearing it.
10. Halfway back to Fraser, mulling over Abra's hat woman, Dan remembered something that sent a jolt straight through him. He almost swerved over the double yellow line, and an oncoming truck westbound on Route 16 honked at him irritably. 12 years ago it had been, when Fraser was still new to him and his sobriety had been extremely shaky. He'd been walking back to Mrs. Robertson's, where he had just that day secured a room. A storm was coming, so Billy Freeman had sent him off with a pair of boots.
They don't look like much, but at least they match.
And as he turned the corner from Moorhead onto Elliott, he'd seen... Just ahead was a rest area. Dan pulled in and walked toward the sound of running water. It was the Saco, of course. It ran through 2 dozen little New Hampshire towns between North Conway and Crawford Notch, connecting them like beads on a string. I saw a hat blowing up the gutter. A battered old top hat like a magician might wear, or an actor in an old musical comedy. Only it wasn't really there, because when I closed my eyes and counted to 5, it was gone.
Okay, it was a shining, he told the running water, but that doesn't necessarily make it the hat Abra saw.
Only he couldn't believe that, because later that night, he dreamed of Deanie. She had been dead, her face hanging off her skull like dough on a stick. Dead and wearing the blanket Dan had stolen from a bum's shopping cart.
Stay away from the woman in the hat, honey bear.
That was what she'd said.
And something else.
What?
She's the queen bitch of Castle Hill.
You don't remember that, he told the running water. Nobody remembers dreams 12 years later. But he did. And now he remembered the rest of what the dead woman from Wilmington had said.
If you mess with her, she'll eat you alive.
11. He let himself into his turret room shortly after 6, carrying a tray of food from the caff. He looked first at the blackboard and smiled at what was printed there.
Thank you for believing me.
As if I had any choice, hon. He erased Abra's message, then sat down at his desk with his dinner. After leaving the rest area, his thoughts had turned back to Dick Halloran. He supposed it was natural enough when someone finally asked you to teach them. You went to your own teacher to find out how to do it. Dan had fallen out of touch with Dick during the drinking years, mostly out of shame, but he thought it might just be possible to find out what had happened to the old fellow. Possibly even to get in touch if Dick was still alive. And hey, lots of people lived into their 90s if they took care of themselves. Abra's great-grandma, for instance, she had to be really getting up there. I need some answers, Dick, and you're the only person I know who might have a few. So do me a favor, my friend, and still be alive. He fired up his computer and opened Firefox. He knew that Dick had spent his winters cooking at a series of Florida resort hotels, but he couldn't remember the names or even which coast they had been on. Probably both. Naples one year, Palm Beach the next, Sarasota or Key West the year after that. There was always work for a man who could tickle palates, especially rich palates, and Dick had been able to tickle them like nobody's business. Dan had an idea that his best shot might be the quirky spelling of Dick's last name. Not H-A-L-L-O-R-A-N, but H-A-L-L-O-R-A-N-N. He typed Richard Halloran and Florida into the search box, then punched Enter. He got back thousands of hits, but he was pretty sure the one he wanted was third from the top, and a soft sigh of disappointment escaped him. He clicked the link, and an article from the Miami Herald appeared. No question. When the age as well as the name appeared in the headline, you knew exactly what you were looking at. Noted South Beach chef Richard Dick Halloran, 81. There was a photo. It was small, but Dan would have recognized that cheerful, knowing face anywhere. Had he died alone? Dan doubted it. The man had been too gregarious and too fond of women. His deathbed had probably been well attended, but the two people he'd saved that winter in Colorado hadn't been there. Wendy Torrance had a valid excuse. She'd predeceased him. Her son, however. Had he been in some dive, full of whiskey and playing truck-driving songs on the jukebox when Dick passed on? Maybe in jail for the night on a drunken disorderly? Cause of death had been a heart attack. He scrolled back up and checked the date. January 19th, 1999. The man who had saved Dan's life and the life of his mother had been dead almost 15 years. There would be no help from that quarter. From behind him, he heard the soft squeak of chalk on slate. He sat where he was for a moment, with his cooling food and his laptop before him. Then slowly, he turned around. The chalk was still on the ledge at the bottom of the blackboard, but a picture was appearing anyway. It was crude, but recognizable. It was a baseball glove. When it was done, her chalk, invisible but still making that low squeaking sound, drew a question mark in the glove's pocket. "I need to think about it," he said, but before he could do so, the intercom buzzed, paging Dr. Sleep. Chapter 9. The Voices of Our Dead Friends. 1. At 102, Eleanor Ouellette was the oldest resident of Rivington House in that fall of 2013, old enough so her last name had never been Americanized. She answered not to Ouellette, but to a much more elegant French pronunciation, Oulay. Dan sometimes called her Miss Ooh-la-la, which always made her smile. Ron Stimpson, one of four docs who made regular day rounds at the hospice, once told Dan that Eleanor was proof that living was sometimes stronger than dying. "Her liver function is nil, her lungs are shut from 80 years of smoking, she has colorectal cancer, moving at a snail's pace but extremely malignant, and the walls of her heart are as thin as a cat's whisker, yet she continues." If Azriel was right, and in Dan's experience he was never wrong, Eleanor's long-term lease on life was about to expire. But she certainly didn't look like a woman on the threshold. She was sitting up in bed stroking the cat when Dan walked in. Her hair was beautifully permed, the hairdresser had been in just the day before, and her pink nightie was as immaculate as always, the top half giving a bit of color to her bloodless cheeks, the bottom half spread away from the sticks of her legs like a ball gown. Dan raised his hands to the sides of his face, the fingers spread and wiggling. "Ooh la la, une belle femme, je suis amoureux." She rolled her eyes and cocked her head and smiled at him.
"Maurice Chevalier, you ain't, but I like your chef. You're cheery, which is important. You're cheeky, which is more important. And you've got a lovely bottom, which is all important. The ass of a man is the piston that drives the world, and you have a good one. In my prime, I would have corked it with my thumb and eaten you alive. Preferably by the pool of Le Meridien, in Monte Carlo, with an admiring audience to applaud my front side and backside efforts.
Her voice, hoarse but cadenced, managed to render this image charming rather than vulgar. To Dan, Eleanor's cigarette rasp was the voice of a cabaret singer who had seen and done it all, even before the German army goose-stepped down the Champs-Élysées in the spring of 1940. Washed up, maybe, but far from washed out. And while it was true she looked like the death of God in spite of the faint color reflected onto her face by her craftily chosen nightgown, she had looked like the death of God since 2009, the year she had moved into Room 15 of Rivington 1. Only Azzy's attendant said that tonight was different. "I'm sure you would have been marvelous," he said.
"Are you seeing any ladies, Shell?"
"Not currently, no.
With one exception, she was years too young for a moor."
"A shame, because in later years, this..."
She raised a bony forefinger, then let it dip.
"Becomes this. You'll see."
He smiled and sat on her bed, as he had sat on so many.
"How are you feeling, Eleanor?"
"Not bad."
She watched Azzy jump down and oil out the door, his work for the evening done.
"I've had many visitors. They made your cat nervous, but he stuck it out until you came."
"He's not my cat, Eleanor. He belongs to the house."
"No,"
she said, as if the subject no longer interested her much.
"He's yours."
Dan doubted if Eleanor had had even one visitor, other than Azriel it was. Not tonight, not in the last week or month, not in the last year. She was alone in the world. Even the dinosaur of an accountant who had overseen her money matters for so many years, lumbering in to visit her once every quarter and toting a briefcase the size of a Saab's trunk, had now gone to his reward. Miss Ooh-La-La claimed to have relatives in Montreal.
"But I have not quite enough money left to make visiting me worthwhile, cher."
"Who's been in, then?" Thinking she might mean Gina Weems or Andrea Botstein, the two nurses working the 3-11 in Riv 1 tonight, or possibly Paul Larson, a slow-moving but decent orderly, whom Dan thought of as the anti-Fred Carling, had stopped by for a natter.
"As I said, many. They are passing even now. An endless parade of them. They smile. They bow. A child wags his tongue like a dog's tail. Some of them speak. Do you know the poet George Safaris?"
"No, ma'am, I don't."
Were there others here? He had reason to believe it was possible, but he had no sense of them. Not that he always did.
"Mr. Safaris asks, are these the voices of our dead friends, or just the gramophone? The children are the saddest. There was a boy here who fell down a well."
"Is that so?"
"Yes, and a woman who committed suicide with a bedspring."
He felt not even the slightest hint of a presence. Could his encounter with Abrastone have sapped him? It was possible, and in any case the shining came and went in tides he had never been able to chart. He didn't think that was it, however. He thought Eleanor had probably lapsed into dementia, or she might be having him on. It wasn't impossible. Quite the wag was Eleanor Ooh-La-La. Someone, was it Oscar Wilde, was reputed to have made a joke on his deathbed. Either that wallpaper goes or I do.
"You are to wait,"
Eleanor said. There was no humor in her voice now.
"The lights will announce an arrival. There may be other disturbances. The door will open. Then your visitor will come."
Dan looked doubtfully at the door to the hall, which was open already. He always left it open so as he could leave if he wanted to. He usually did once Dan showed up to take over.
"Eleanor, would you like some cold juice?"
"I would, if there were time,"
she began,
and then the life ran out of her face like water from a basin with a hole in it. Her eyes fixed at a point over his head, and her mouth fell open. Her cheeks sagged, and her chin dropped almost to her scrawny chest. The top plate of her dentures also dropped, slid over her lower lip, and hung in an unsettling open-air grin. Fuck, that was quick. Carefully, he hooked a finger beneath the denture plate and removed it. Her lip pulled out, then snapped back with a tiny plip sound. Dan put the plate on her night table, started to get up, then settled back. He waited for the red mist the old Tampa nurse had called the gasp, as though it were a pulling in instead of a letting out. It didn't come.
You are to wait.
All right, he could do that, at least for a while. He reached for Abra's mind and found nothing. Maybe that was good. She might already be taking pains to guard her thoughts. Or maybe his own ability, his sensitivity, had departed. If so, it didn't matter. It would be back. It always had been, at any rate. He wondered, as he had before, why he had never seen flies on the face of any Rivington House guest. Maybe because he didn't need to. He had Azzy, after all. Did Azzy see something with those wise green eyes of his? Maybe not flies, but something? He must.
Are these the voices of our dead friends, or just the gramophone?
It was so quiet on this floor tonight, and still so early. There was no sound of conversation from the common room at the end of the hall. No TV or radio played. He couldn't hear the squeak of Poole's sneakers or the low voices of Gina or Andrea down at the nurse's station. No phone rang. As for his watch, Dan raised it. No wonder he couldn't hear its faint ticking. It had stopped. The overhead fluorescent bar went off, leaving only Eleanor's table lamp. The fluorescent came back on, and the lamp flickered out. It came on again, and then it and the overhead went off together. On. Off. On. Is someone here? The picture on the night table rattled, then stilled. The dentures he had removed gave a single unsettling clack. A queer ripple ran along the sheet of Eleanor's bed as if something beneath it had been startled into sudden motion. A puff of warm air pressed a quick kiss against Dan's cheek, then was gone. Who is it? His heartbeat remained regular, but he could feel it in his neck and wrists. The hair on the back of his neck felt thick and stiff. He suddenly knew what Eleanor had been seeing in her last moments. A parade of ghosty people, the dead, passing into her room from one wall and passing out through the other. Passing out? No, passing on. He didn't know Seferis, but he knew Auden. Death takes the rolling in money, the screamingly funny, and those who are very well hung. She had seen them all, and they were here But they weren't. He knew they weren't. The ghosts Eleanor had seen were gone, and she had joined their parade. He had been told to wait. He was waiting. The door to the hall swung slowly shut. Then the bathroom door opened. From Eleanor Ule's dead mouth came a single word. Danny.
2. When you enter the town of Sidewinder, you pass a sign reading, Welcome to the Top of America. It isn't, but it's close. 20 miles from the place where the eastern slope becomes the western, a dirt road splits off from the main highway, winding north. The burned-in wood sign arched over this byway reads, Welcome to the Bluebell Campground. Stay a while, partner. That sounds like good old western hospitality. But locals know that more often than not, the road is gated shut, and when it is, a less friendly sign hangs from it. Closed until further notice. How they do business is a mystery to the folks in Sidewinder who'd like to see the Bluebell open every day the upcountry roads aren't snowed in. They missed the commerce the overlook used to bring in and hoped the campground would at least partially make up for it, although they know that camper people don't have the kind of money the hotel people used to pump into the local economy. That hasn't been the case. The general consensus is that the campground is some rich corporation's tax haven, a designated money loser. It's a haven, all right, but the corporation it shelters is the True Knot, and when they are in residence, the only RVs in the big parking lot are their RVs, with Rose the Hat's Earth Cruiser standing tallest among them. On that September evening, 9 members of the True were gathered in the high-ceilinged, pleasantly rustic building known as Overlook Lodge. When the campground was open to the public, the lodge served as a restaurant that put on 2 meals a day, breakfast and dinner. The food was prepared by Short Eddie and Big Mo, Rube names Ed and Maureen Higgins. Neither was up to Dick Halloran's culinary standards. Few were, but it's hard to screw up too badly on the things camper people like to eat. Meatloaf, macaroni and cheese, meatloaf, pancakes drenched in log cabin syrup, meatloaf, chicken stew, meatloaf, tuna surprise, and meatloaf with mushroom gravy. After dinner, the tables were cleared for bingo or card parties. On weekends, there were dances. These festivities took place only when the campground was open. This evening, as 3 time zones east, Dan Torrance sat beside a dead woman and waited for his visitor, there was business of a different sort to transact in Overlook Lodge. Jimmy Numbers was at the head of a single table that had been set up in the middle of the polished bird's-eye maple floor. His power book was open, the desktop displaying a photograph of his hometown, which happened to be deep in the Carpathian Mountains. Jimmy liked to joke that his grandfather had once entertained a young London solicitor named Jonathan Harker. Clustered around him, looking down at the screen, were Rose, Crow Daddy, Barry the Chink, Snakebite Andy, Token Charlie, Apron Annie, Diesel Doug, and Grandpa Flick. None of them wanted to stand next to Grandpa, who smelled as if he might have had a minor disaster in his pants and then forgotten to shower it off, a thing that happened more and more frequently these days, but this was important, and they put up with him. Jimmy Numbers was an unassuming guy with a receding hairline and a pleasant, if vaguely simian face. He looked about 50, which was 1/3 of his actual age.
"I googled lickety-spliff and got nothing useful, which is what I expected. In case you care, lickety-spliff is teenage slang that means to do something really slow instead of really fast."
"We don't," Diesel Doug said. "And by the way, you smell a trifle rank, Gramps. No offense, but when was the last time you wiped your ass?"
Grandpa Flick bared his teeth, eroded and yellow, but all his own at Doug. "Your wife wiped it for me just this morning, Deez. With her face, as it happens. Kind of nasty, but she seems to like that kind of thing."
"Shut your heads, both of you," Rose said. Her voice was toneless and unthreatening, but Doug and Grandpa both shrank away from her, their faces those of chastened schoolboys. "Go on, Jimmy, but stay on point. I want to have a concrete plan, and soon."
"The rest of them are going to be reluctant, no matter how concrete the plan is," Crow said. "They're going to say it's been a good year for steam. That movie theater thing, the church fire in Little Rock, and the terrorist thing in Austin. Not to mention Juarez. I was dubious about going south of the border, but it was good."
"Better than good, actually. Juarez had become known as the murder capital of the world, earning its sobriquet with over 2,500 homicides a year. Many were torture killings. The pervading atmosphere had been exceedingly rich. It wasn't pure steam, and it made you feel a little whoopsie in the stomach, but it did the job."
"All those fucking beans gave me the runs," Token Charlie said. "But I have to admit, the pickings were excellent."
"It was a good year," Rose agreed. "But we can't make a business of Mexico. We're too conspicuous. Down there, we're rich Americanos. Up here, we fade into the woodwork, And aren't you tired of living from year to year? Always on the move and always counting canisters? This is different. This is the mother load. None of them replied. She was their leader, and in the end they would do what she said. But they didn't understand about the girl. That was all right. When they encountered her for themselves, they would. And when they had her locked up and producing steam pretty much to order, they'd offer to get down on their knees and kiss Rose's feet. She might even take them up on it. Go on, Jimmy, but get to the point.
I'm pretty sure what you picked up was a teen slang version of lickety-split. It's a chain of New England convenience stores. There are 73 in all, from Providence to Presque Isle. A grammar school kid with an iPad could have nailed that in about 2 minutes. I printed out the locations and used World 360 to get pics. I found 6 that have mountain views. 2 in Vermont, 2 in New Hampshire, and 2 in Maine.
His laptop case was under his chair. He grabbed it, fumbled in the flap pocket, brought out a folder, and handed it to Rose.
These aren't pictures of the stores. They're pictures of various mountain views that can be seen from the neighborhoods the stores are in. Once more, courtesy of World 360, which is far better than Google Earth, and God bless its nosy little heart. Take a look and see if any ring a bell. If not, see if there are any you can definitely eliminate.
Rose opened the folder and slowly went through the photographs. The 2 showing Vermont's Green Mountains she put aside at once. One of the main locations was also wrong. It showed only 1 mountain, and she had seen a whole range of them. The other 3 she looked at longer. Finally, she handed them back to Jimmy Numbers.
One of these.
He turned the pictures over.
Fryeburg, Maine. Madison, New Hampshire. Anniston, New Hampshire. Got a feel for which one of the 3?
Rose took them again, then held up the photos of the White Mountains as seen from Fryeburg and Anniston.
I think it's one of these, but I'm going to make sure.
How are you going to do that? Crow asked.
I'm going to visit her.
If everything you say is true, that could be dangerous.
I'll do it when she's asleep. Young girls sleep deeply. She'll never know I was there.
Are you sure you need to do that? These 3 places are pretty close together. We could check them all.
Yes, Rose cried. We'll just cruise around and say we're looking for a local girl, but we can't seem to read her location the way we normally can, so give us a little help. Have you noticed any junior high girls around here with precognition or mind-reading talents?
Crow Daddy gave a sigh, stuck his big hands deep in his pockets, and looked at her.
I'm sorry, Rose said. I'm a little on edge, all right? I want to do this and get it done, and you don't have to worry about me. I can take care of myself.
3. Dan sat looking at the late Eleanor Ulle, the open eyes now beginning to glaze, the tiny hands with their palms upturned, most of all at the open mouth. Inside was all the clockless silence of death.
Who are you? Thinking, as if I didn't know. Hadn't he wished for answers?
You grew up fine.
The lips didn't move, and there seemed to be no emotion in the words. Perhaps death had robbed his old friend of his human feelings, and what a bitter shame that would be. Or perhaps it was someone else masquerading as Dick. Something else.
If you're Dick, prove it. Tell me something only he and I could know.
Silence. But the presence was still here. He felt it. Then,
You asked me why Mrs. Brandt wanted to car park man's pants.
Dan at first had no idea what the voice was talking about. Then he did. The memory was on one of the high shelves where he kept all the bad overlooked memories, and his lockboxes, of course. Mrs. Brandt had been a checkout on the day Danny arrived with his parents, and he had caught a random thought from her as the overlook's valet delivered her car.
I'd sure like to get into his pants. You were just a little boy with a great big radio inside your head. I felt sorry for you. I was scared for you, too.
And I was right to be scared, wasn't I? In that, there was a faint echo of his old friend's kindness and humor. It was Dick, all right. Dan looked at the dead woman, dumbfounded. The lights in the room flickered on and off again. The water pitcher gave another brief jitter.
I can't stay long, son. It hurts to be here.
Dick, there's a little girl.
Abra, almost a sigh. She's like you. It all comes around.
She thinks there's a woman who may be after her. She wears a hat. It's an old-fashioned top hat. Sometimes she only has one long tooth on top. When she's hungry. This is what she told me, anyway.
Ask your question, son. I can't stay. This world is a dream of a dream to me now.
There are others, the top hat woman's friends. Abra saw them with flashlights. Who are they? Silence again. But Dick was still there. Changed, but there. Dan could feel him in his nerve endings and as a kind of electricity skating on the damp surfaces of his eyes.
They are the empty devils. They are sick and don't know it.
I don't understand.
No, and that's good. If you had ever met them, if they had ever gotten so much as a sniff of you, you'd be long dead, used and thrown away like an empty carton. That's what happened to the one Abra calls the baseball boy, and many others. Children who shine are prey to them. But you already guessed that, didn't you? The empty devils are on the land like a cancer on the skin. Once they rode camels in the desert. Once they drove caravans across Eastern Europe. They eat screams and drink pain. You had your horrors at the Overlook, Danny, but at least you were spared these folks. Now that the strange woman has her mind fixed on the girl, they won't stop until they have her. They might kill her. They might turn her. Or they might keep her and use her until she's all used up, and that would be worst of all. I don't understand. Scoop her out. Make her empty like them. From the dead mouth there came an autumnal sigh. Dick, what the hell am I supposed to do? Get the girl what she asked for. Where are they, these empty devils? In your childhood. Where every devil comes from. I'm not allowed to say more. How do I stop them? The only way is to kill them. Make them eat their own poison. Do that and they disappear. The woman in the hat, the strange woman, what's her name? Do you know? From down the hall came the clash of a mop bucket squeegee and Paul Larson began to whistle. The air in the room changed. Something that had been delicately balanced now began to swing out of true. Go to your friends, the ones who know what you are. It seems to me you grew up fine, son, but you still owe a debt.
There was a pause, and then the voice that both was and wasn't Dick Halloran's spoke one final time, in a tone of flat command.
Pay it.
Red mist rose from Eleanor's eyes, nose, and open mouth. It hung over her for perhaps 5 seconds, then disappeared. The lights were steady. So was the water in the pitcher. Dick was gone. Dan was here with only a corpse.
Empty devils.
If he had ever heard a more terrible phrase, he couldn't remember it. But it made sense if you had seen the Overlook for what it really was. That place had been full of devils, but at least they had been dead devils. He didn't think that was true of the woman in the top hat and her friends. You still owe a debt. Pay it. Yes. He had left the little boy in the sagging diaper and the Braves t-shirt to fend for himself. He would not do that with the girl.
4. Dan waited at the nurse's station for the funeral hack from Geordie and Sons and saw the covered gurney out the back door of Rivington 1. Then he went to his room and sat looking down at Cranmore Avenue, now perfectly deserted. A night wind blew, stripping the early turning leaves from the oaks and sending them dancing and pirouetting up the street. On the far side of the town common, Teeny Town was equally deserted beneath a couple of orange high-intensity security lights.
Go to your friends, the ones who know what you are.
Billy Freeman knew. Had almost from the first, because Billy had some of what Dan had. And if Dan owed a debt, he supposed Billy did too, because Dan's larger and brighter shining had saved Billy's life. Not that I'd put it that way to him. Not that he'd have to. Then there was John Dalton, who had lost a watch and who just happened to be Abra's pediatrician. What had Dick said through Eleanor Ooh-La-La's dead mouth? It all comes around. As for the thing Abra had asked for, that was even easier. Getting it, though, that might be a little complicated.
5.
When Abra got up on Sunday morning, there was an email message from dtor36@nhml.com. Abra, I have spoken to a friend using the talent we share and am convinced that you are in danger. I want to speak about your situation to another friend, one we have in common, John Dalton. I will not do so unless I have your permission. I believe John and I can retrieve the object you drew on my blackboard. Have you set your burglar alarm? Certain people may be looking for you, and it's very important they not find you. You must be careful. Good wishes, and stay safe. Delete this email. Uncle D. She was more convinced by the fact of his email than its content, because she knew he didn't like communicating that way. He was afraid her parents would snoop in her mail and think she was exchanging notes with Chester the molester. If they only knew about the molester she really had to worry about. She was frightened, but also, now that it was bright daylight and there was no beautiful lunatic in a top hat peering in the window at her, rather excited. It was sort of like being in one of those love and horror supernatural novels, the kind Mrs. Robinson in the school library sniffily called tweenager porn. In those books, the girls dallied with werewolves, vampires, even zombies, but hardly ever became those things. It was also nice to have a grown man stand up for her, and it didn't hurt that he was handsome. In a scruffy kind of way that reminded her a little of Jax Teller on Sons of Anarchy, a show she and Emma Dean secretly watched on Em's computer. She sent Uncle Dan's email not just to her trash, but to the permanent trash, which Emma called the nuclear boyfriend file. As if you had any, Em, Abra thought snidely. Then she turned off her computer and closed the lid. She didn't email him back. She didn't have to. She just had to close her eyes. Zip, zip. Message sent. Abra headed for the shower.
6. When Dan came back with his morning coffee, there was a new communique on his blackboard.
You can tell Dr. John
but not my parents. No, not her parents. At least not yet. But Dan had no doubt they'd find out something was going on, and probably sooner rather than later. He would cross that bridge, or burn it, when he came to it. Right now he had a lot of other things to do, beginning with a call. A child answered, and when he asked for Rebecca, the phone was dropped with a clunk, and there was a distant, going-away cry of, "Grandma, it's for you!" A few seconds later, Rebecca Clausen was on the line. "Hi, Becca. It's Dan Torrance."
"It was about Mrs. Willard. I had an email this morning from..."
"That's not it. I need to ask for some time off."
"Dr. Sleep wants time off? I don't believe it. I had to practically kick you out the door last spring to take your vacation, and you were still in once or twice a day. Is it a family matter?"
Dan, with Abra's theory of relativity in mind, said it was. Chapter 10. Glass Ornaments. 1. Abra's father was standing at the kitchen counter in his bathrobe and beating eggs in a bowl when the kitchen phone rang. Upstairs, the shower was pounding. If Abra followed her usual Sunday morning M.O., it would continue to pound until the hot water gave out. He checked the incoming call window. It was a 617 area code, but the number following wasn't the one in Boston he knew, the one that rang the landline in his grandmother-in-law's condo. "Hello?"
"Oh, David, I'm so glad I got you."
It was Lucy, and she sounded utterly exhausted.
"Where are you? Why aren't you calling from your cell?"
"Mass General, on a payphone. You can't use cells in here. There are signs everywhere."
"Is Momo all right? Are you?"
"I am. As for Moms, she's stable. Now. But for a while it was pretty bad."
A gulp.
"It still is."
That was when Lucy broke down. Not just crying, but sobbing her heart out. David waited. He was glad Abra was in the shower and hoped the hot water would hold out for a long time. This sounded bad. At last, Lucy was able to talk again.
"This time, she broke her arm."
"Oh. Okay. Is that all?"
"No, it is not all."
Nearly shouting at him in that "why are men so stupid" voice that he absolutely loathed, the one he told himself was a part of her Italian heritage, without ever considering that he might, on occasion, actually be quite stupid. He took a steadying breath. "Tell me, honey." She did, although twice she broke into sobs again and David had to wait her out. She was dead beat, but that was only part of the problem. Mostly, he realized, she was just accepting in her gut what her head had known for weeks. Her Momo was really going to die. Maybe not peacefully. Conchetta, who slept in only the thinnest of dozes now, had awakened after midnight and needed the toilet. Instead of buzzing for Lucy to bring the bedpan, she had tried to get up and go to the bathroom by herself. She had managed to swing her legs out onto the floor and sit up, but then dizziness had overcome her and she had tumbled off the bed, landing on her left arm. It hadn't just broken, it had shattered. Lucy, tired out from weeks of night nursing that she had never been trained to do, awoke to the sound of her grandmother's cries.
"She wasn't just calling for help," Lucy said, "and she wasn't screaming either. She was shrieking. Like a fox that's had a limb torn off in one of those terrible leg-hold traps."
"Honey, that must have been awful." Standing in a first-floor alcove where there were snack machines and mirabile dictu, a few working phones, her body aching and covered with drying sweat, she could smell herself and it sure wasn't Dolce and Gabbana light blue, her head pounding with the first migraine she'd had in 4 years. Lucia Stone knew she could never tell him how awful it had really been. What a stinking revelation it had been. "You thought you understood the basic fact. Woman grows old,
Woman grows feeble, woman dies, and then you discovered there was quite a lot more to it. You found that out when you found the woman who had written some of the greatest poetry of her generation lying in a puddle of her own piss, shrieking at her granddaughter to make the pain stop, make it stop. Oh, Madre de Cristo, make it stop. When you saw the formerly smooth forearm twisted like a wash rag and heard the poet call it a cunting thing and then wish herself dead so the hurting would stop. Could you tell your husband how you were still half asleep and frozen with the fear that anything you did would be the wrong thing? Could you tell him that she scratched your face when you tried to move her and howled like a dog that had been run over in the street? Could you explain what it was like to leave your beloved grandmother sprawled on the floor while you dialed 911 and then sat beside her waiting for the ambulance, making her drink oxycodone dissolved in water through a bendy straw? How the ambulance didn't come and didn't come, and you thought of that Gordon Lightfoot song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the one that asks if anyone knows where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours. The waves rolling over Momo were waves of pain, and she was foundering, and they just kept coming. When she began to scream again, Lucy had gotten both arms under her and lifted her onto her bed in a clumsy, clean and jerk that she knew she'd feel in her shoulders and lower back for days, if not weeks. Stopping her ears to Momo's cries of, "Put me down! You're killing me!" Then Lucy sat against the wall gasping, her hair plastered to her cheeks in strings while Momo wept and cradled her hideously deformed arm and asked why Lucia would hurt her like that and why this was happening to her. At last the ambulance had come, and a man, Lucy didn't know his name, but blessed him in her incoherent prayers, had given Momo a shot that put her out. Could you tell your husband you wished the shot had killed her? "It was pretty awful," was all she said. "I'm so glad Abra didn't want to come down this weekend."
"She did, but she had lots of homework and said she had to go to the library yesterday. It must have been a big deal because you know how she usually pesters me about going to the football game."
Babbling. Stupid. But what else was there?
"Luce, I'm so goddamn sorry you had to go through that alone."
"It's just, if you could have heard her screaming, then you might understand. I never want to hear anyone scream like that again. She's always been so great at staying calm, keeping her head when all about her are losing theirs."
"I know."
"And then to be reduced to what she was last night.
The only words she could remember were cunt and shit and piss and fuck and meretrice and..."
"Let it go, honey."
Upstairs the shower had quit. It would only take Abra a few minutes to dry off and jump into her Sunday grubs. She'd be down soon enough, shirt tail flying and sneaker laces flapping. But Lucy wasn't quite ready to let it go.
"I remember a poem she wrote once. I can't quote it word for word, but it started something like this. God's a connoisseur of fragile things, and decorates his cloudy outlook with ornaments of finest glass. I used to think that was a rather conventionally pretty idea for a Concetta Reynolds poem. Almost twee."
And here was his Abadou. There, Abadou, with her skin flushed from the shower.
"Everything all right, Daddy?"
David held up a hand. "Wait a minute. Now I know what she really meant, and I'll never be able to read that poem again." "Abby's here, hon," he said in a falsely jolly voice.
"Good. I'll need to talk to her. I'm not going to bawl anymore, so don't worry. But we can't protect her from this."
"Maybe from the worst of it?" he asked gently. Abra was standing by the table, her wet hair pulled into a couple of horsetails that made her look 10 again. Her expression was grave.
"Maybe," she agreed. "But I can't do this anymore, Davy. Not even with day help. I thought I could, but I can't. There's a hospice in Fraser, just a little way down the road. The intake nurse told me about it. I think hospitals must keep a list for just this type of situation. Anyway, the place is called Helen Rivington House. I called them before I called you, and they have a vacancy as of today. I guess God pushed another of his ornaments off the mantelpiece last night." Is Chetta awake? Have you discussed this? She came around a couple of hours ago, but she was muddy. Had the past and present all mixed together in a kind of salad.
While I was still fast asleep, David thought guiltily. Dreaming about my book, no doubt.
When she clears up, I'm assuming she will, I'll tell her, as gently as I can, that the decision isn't hers to make. It's time for hospice care.
All right. When Lucy decided something, really decided, the best thing was to stand clear and let her work her will.
Dad? Is Mom okay? Is Momo?
Abra knew her mother was and her great-grandmother wasn't. Most of what Lucy had told her husband had come to her while she was still in the shower, standing there with shampoo and tears running down her cheeks. But she had gotten good at putting on happy faces until someone told her out loud that it was time to put on a sad one. She wondered if her new friend Dan had learned about the happy face thing as a kid. She bet he had.
Chia, I think Abby wants to talk to you.
Lucy sighed and said, "Put her on."
David held out the phone to his daughter. 2.
At 2 p.m. on that Sunday, Rose the Hat hung a sign reading, "Do not disturb me unless absolutely necessary," on the door of her plus-size RV. The coming hours had been carefully scheduled. She would eat no food today and drink only water. Instead of mid-morning coffee, she had taken an emetic. When the time came to go after the girl's mind, she would be as clear as an empty glass. With no bodily functions to distract her, Rose would be able to find out everything she needed. The girl's name, her exact location, how much she knew, and, this was very important, who she might have talked to. Rose would lie still on her double bed in the Earth Cruiser from 4 in the afternoon until 10 in the evening, looking up at the ceiling and meditating. When her mind was as clear as her body, she would take steam from one of the canisters in the hidden compartment. Just a whiff would be enough, and once again, turn the world until she was in the girl, and the girl was in her. At 1 in the morning Eastern time, her quarry would be dead asleep, and Rose could pick through the contents of her mind at will. It might even be possible to plant a suggestion. Some men will come. They will help you. Go with them. But as that old-school farmer poet Bobby Burns pointed out more than 200 years before, the best-laid plans of mice and men gang aft agley, and she had barely begun to recite the beginning phrases of her relaxation mantra when an agley came hammering at her door.
"Go away," she shouted. "Can't you read the sign?"
"Rose, I've got Nut with me," Crow called. "I think he's got what you asked for, but he needs a go-ahead, and the timing on this thing is a bitch."
She lay there for a moment, then blew out an angry breath and got up, snatching the Sidewinder T-shirt, "Kiss Me at the Roof of the World," and pulling it over her head. It dropped to the tops of her thighs. She opened the door. This better be good.
"We can come back," Walnut said.
He was a little man with a bald pate and Brillo pads of gray hair fluffing out above the tops of his ears. He held a sheet of paper in one hand.
"No, just make it quick."
They sat at the table in the combined kitchen-living room. Rose snatched the paper from Nut's hand and gave it a cursory glance. It was some sort of complicated chemical diagram filled with hexagons. It meant nothing to her. "What is it?"
"A powerful sedative," Nut said. "It's new, and it's clean. Jimmy got this chem sheet from one of our assets in the NSA. It'll put her out with no chance of ODing her."
"It could be what we need, all right."
Rose knew she sounded grudging.
"But couldn't it have waited until tomorrow?"
Sorry, Nut said meekly.
I'm not, Crow said. If you want to move fast on this girl and snatch her clean, I'll not only have to make sure we can get some of this, I'll have to arrange for it to be shipped to one of our mail drops.
The True had hundreds of these across America, most of them at mailboxes, etc., and various UPS stores. Using them meant planning days ahead because they always traveled in their RVs. Members of the True would no more get on public transportation than they would slit their own throats. Private air travel was possible, but unpleasant. They suffered extreme altitude sickness. Walnut believed it had something to do with their nervous systems, which differed radically from those of the Rubes. Rose's concern was with a certain taxpayer-funded nervous system. Very nervous. Homeland Security had been monitoring even private flights very closely since 9/11, and the True Knot's first rule of survival was never attract attention. Thanks to the interstate highway system, the RVs had always served their purposes and would this time. A small raiding party, with new drivers taking the wheel every 6 hours, could get from Sidewinder to northern New England in less than 30 hours. All right, she said, mollified. What have we got along I-90 in upstate New York or Massachusetts?
Crow didn't hem and haw or tell her he'd have to get back to her on that. Easy mail services in Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
She flapped her fingers at the edge of the sheet of incomprehensible chemistry Nut was holding in his hand. Have this stuff sent there. Use at least 3 cutouts so we have complete deniability if something goes wrong. Really bounce it around.
Do we have that much time? Crow asked.
I don't see why not, Rose said, a remark that would come back to haunt her. Send it south, then into the Midwest, then into New England. Just get it to Sturbridge by Thursday. Use express mail, not FedEx or UPS.
I can do that, Crow said, no hesitation.
Rose turned her attention to the True's doctor. You better be right, Walnut. If you do OD her instead of just putting her to sleep, I'll see you're the first True to be sent into exile since Little Bighorn.
Walnut paled a little.
Good. She had no intention of exiling anyone, but she still resented being interrupted.
We'll get the drug to Sturbridge, and Nut will know how to use it, Crow said. No problem.
There's nothing simpler. Something we can get around here.
Nut said, not if you want to be sure she doesn't go Michael Jackson on us. This stuff is safe, and it hits fast. If she's as powerful as you seem to think, fast is going to be important.
Okay, okay, I get it. Are we done here?
There's one more thing, Walnut said. I suppose it could wait, but...
She looked out the window, and ye gods and little fishes, here came Jimmy Numbers, bustling across the parking lot adjacent to the Overlook Lodge with his own sheet of paper. Why had she hung the Do Not Disturb sign on her doorknob? Why not one that said, Y'all come? Rose gathered all her bad temper, stuffed it in a sack, stored it at the back of her mind, and smiled gamely. What is it?
Grandpa Flick, Crow said, is no longer holding his fudge.
He hasn't been able to hold it for the last 20 years, Rose said. He won't wear diapers, and I can't make him. No one can make him.
This is different, Nut said. I can barely get out of bed. Baba and Black-Eyed Susie are taking care of him as well as they can, but that camper of his smells like the wrath of God.
He'll get better. We'll feed him some steam. But she didn't like the look on Nut's face. Tommy the truck had passed 2 years ago. And by the way the True measured time, that might have been 2 weeks ago. Now, Grandpa Flick?
His mind's breaking down, Crow said bluntly. And, he looked at Walnut. Petty was taking care of him this morning, and she says she thinks she saw him cycle.
Thinks, Rose said. She didn't want to believe it. Has anyone else seen it happen? Baba? Sue?
No.
She shrugged as if to say, there you are. Jimmy knocked before they could discuss it farther, and this time she was glad for the interruption. "Come in!" Jimmy poked his head through.
"Sure, it's okay."
"Yes, why don't you bring the Rockettes and the UCLA marching band while you're at it? Hell, I was only trying to get in a meditation groove after a few pleasant hours of spewing my guts."
Crow was giving her a look of mild reproof, and maybe she deserved it. Probably she deserved it. These people were only doing the True's work as she had asked them to do it. But if Crow ever stepped up to the captain's chair, he'd understand. Never a moment to yourself unless you threatened them with pain of death. And in many cases, not even then.
"I got something you may want to see," Jimmy said. "And since Crow and Nut were already here, I figured..."
"I know what you figured. What is it?"
"I went hunting around on the internet for news about those two towns you zeroed in on. Freiburg and Anniston. Found this in the Union Leader. It's from last Thursday's paper. Maybe it's nothing."
She took the sheet. The main item was about some podunk school shutting down their football program because of budget cuts. Beneath it was a shorter item which Jimmy had circled.
"Pocket earthquake reported in Anniston. How small can an earthquake be?" "Pretty small, if the people of Richland Court, a short Anniston street that dead ends at the Saco River, are to be believed. Late Tuesday afternoon, several residents of the street reported a tremor that rattled windows, shook floors, and sent glassware tumbling from shelves. Dane Borland, a retiree who lives at the end of the street, pointed out a crack running the width of his newly asphalted driveway. 'If you want proof, there it is,' he said." Although the Geological Survey Center in Wrentham, Massachusetts, reports there were no timblers in New England last Tuesday afternoon, Matt and Cassie Renfrew took the opportunity to throw an earthquake party, which most of the street's residents attended. Andrew Sittenfeld of the Geological Survey Center says the shaking felt by Richland Court residents might have been a surge of water through the sewer system, or possibly a military plane breaking the sound barrier. When these suggestions were made to Mr. Renfrew, he laughed cheerfully. "We know what we felt," he said. "It was an earthquake, and there's really no downside. The damage was minor, and hey, we got a terrific party out of it." Andrew Gould.
Rose read it twice, then looked up, eyes bright. "Good catch, Jimmy." He grinned.
"Thanks. I'll leave you guys to it, then."
"Take Nut with you. He needs to check on Grandpa. Crow, you stay a minute."
When they were gone, he closed the door.
"You think the girl caused that shake in New Hampshire?"
"I do. Not 100% certain, but at least 80. And having a place to focus on, not just a town, but a street, will make things a hell of a lot easier for me tonight when I go looking for her."
"If you can stick a come-along worm in her head, Rosie, we may not even need to knock her out."
She smiled, thinking again that Crow had no idea how special this one was. Later she would think, "Neither did I. I only thought I did."
"There's no law against hoping, I suppose, but once we have her, we'll need something a little more sophisticated than a Mickey Finn, even if it's a high-tech one. We'll need some wonder drug that'll keep her nice and cooperative until she decides it's in her best interest to cooperate on her own."
"Will you be coming with us when we go to grab her?"
Rose had assumed so, but now she hesitated, thinking of Grandpa Flick. "I'm not sure."
He didn't ask questions, which she appreciated, and turned to the door. "I'll see that you're not disturbed again."
"Good. And you make sure Walnut gives Grandpa a complete exam. I mean, from asshole to appetite. If he really is cycling, I want to know tomorrow when I come out of Perda." She opened the compartment under the floor and brought out one of the canisters.
And give him what's left in this.
Crow was shocked. All of it. Rose, if he's cycling, there's no point.
Give it to him. We've had a good year, as several of you have pointed out to me lately.
We can afford a little extravagance.
Besides, the True Knot only has one grandpa. He remembers when the people of Europe worshipped trees instead of timeshare condos. We're not going to lose him if we can help it. We're not savages.
The rubes might beg to differ.
That's why they're rubes. Now get out of here.
3. After Labor Day, Teeny Town closed at 3 p.m. on Sundays. This afternoon at 5:45, three giants sat on benches near the end of the mini Cranmore Avenue, dwarfing Teeny Town Drug and the Teeny Town Music Box Theater, where during tourist season you could peek in the window and see teeny film clips playing on a teeny screen. John Dalton had come to the meeting wearing a Red Sox hat, which he placed on the head of the teeny Helen Rivington statue in the teeny courthouse square.
"I'm sure she was a fan," he said. "Everybody up this way is a fan. Nobody spares a little admiration for the Yankees except exiles like me. What can I do for you, Dan? I'm missing supper with the family for this. My wife's an understanding woman, but her patience only stretches so far."
"How would she feel about you spending a few days with me in Iowa?" Dan asked. "Strictly on my dime, you understand. I have to make a 12th-step call on an uncle who's killing himself with booze and cocaine. My family's begging me to step in, and I can't do it alone." AA had no rules, but many traditions that were, in fact, rules. One of the most ironclad was that you never made a 12th-step call on an active alcoholic by yourself, unless the alky in question was safely incarcerated in a hospital, detox, or the local bug house. If you did, you were apt to end up matching him drink for drink and line for line. Addiction, Casey Kingsley liked to say, was the gift that kept on giving. Dan looked at Billy Freeman and smiled.
"Got something to say?
Go ahead, feel free."
"I don't think you got an uncle. I'm not sure you've got any family left at all."
"Is that it? You're just not sure?"
"Well, you never talk about them."
"Plenty of people have family and don't talk about them. But you know I don't have anyone, don't you, Billy?" Billy said nothing but looked uneasy.
"Denny, I can't go to Iowa," John said. "I'm booked right into the weekend."
Dan was still focused on Billy. Now he reached into his pocket, grabbed something, and held out his closed fist. "What have I got?" Billy looked more uneasy than ever. He glanced at John, saw no help there, then back to Dan. "John knows what I am," Dan said. "I helped him once, and he knows I've helped a few others in the program. You're among friends here." Billy thought about it, then said,
"It might be a coin, but I think it's one of your AA medals. The kind they give you every time you're getting another year sober."
"What year's this one?" Billy hesitated, looking at Dan's fisted hand.
"Let me help you out," John said. "He's been sober since the spring of 2001, so if he's carrying a medallion around, it's probably a year 12.
"Makes sense, but it ain't." Billy was concentrating now, two deep vertical lines grooving his forehead just about his eyes.
"I think it might be a 7.
Dan opened his palm. The medallion had a big Roman numeral 6 on it.
"Fuckaroo," Billy said. "I'm usually good at guessing."
"You were close enough," Dan said. "And it's not guessing. It's shining." Billy took out his cigarettes, looked at the doctor sitting on the bench next to him, and put them back.
"If you say so."
"Let me tell you a little about yourself, Billy. When you were small, you were great at guessing things. You knew when your mother was in a good mood and you could hit her for an extra buck or two. You knew when your dad was in a bad one and you steered clear of him.
I sure knew there were nights when bitching about having to eat leftover pot roast would be a goddamn bad idea,
Billy said. Did you gamble?
Horse races down Salem. Made a bundle. Then, when I was 25 or so, I kind of lost the knack of picking winners. I had a month when I had to beg an extension on the rent, and that cured me of rail burden.
Yes, the talent fades as people grow older, but you still have some.
You got more,
Billy said, no hesitation now. This is real, isn't it? John said. It really wasn't a question, it was an observation. You've only got one appointment this coming week you really feel you can't miss or hand off, Dan said. It's a little girl with stomach cancer. Her name is Felicity. Frederica, John said. Frederica Bimmel. She's at Merrimack Valley Hospital. I'm supposed to have a consult with her oncologist and her parents. Saturday morning. Yeah. Saturday morning. He gave Dan an amazed look. Jesus. Jesus Christ. What you have. I had no idea there was so much of it. I'll have you back from Iowa by Thursday. Friday at the latest. Unless we get arrested, he thought. Then we might be there a while longer. He looked to see if Billy had picked up that less than encouraging thought. There was no sign that he had. What's this about? Another patient of yours. Abra Stone. She's like Billy and me, John, but I think you already know that. Only she's much, much more powerful. I've got quite a lot more than Billy, and she makes me look like a fortune teller at a county fair. Oh, my God. The spoons. It took Dan a second, then he remembered. She hung them on the ceiling. John stared at him wide-eyed. You read that in my mind? A little more mundane than that, I'm afraid. She told me. When? When? We'll get there, but not yet. First, let's try for some authentic mind reading. Dan took John's hand. That helped. Contact almost always did. Her parents came to see you when she was just a toddler. Or maybe it was an aunt or her great-gram. They were concerned about her, even before she decorated the kitchen with silverware, because there was all sorts of psychic phenomena going on in that house. There was something about the piano. Billy, help me out here. Billy grabbed John's free hand. Dan took Billy's, making a connected circle. A teeny seance in Teeny Town.
Beatles music, Billy said. On the piano, instead of the guitar. It was, I don't know. It made him crazy for a while.
John stared at him. Listen, Dan said. You have her permission to talk. She wants you to. Trust me on this, John. John Dalton considered for almost a full minute. Then he told them everything, with one exception. That stuff about the Simpsons being on all the TV channels was just too weird. 4. When he was finished, John asked the obvious question, how did Dan know Abra Stone? From his back pocket, Dan produced a small battered notebook. On the cover was a photo of waves crashing against a headland, and the motto, No Great Thing Is Created Suddenly. You used to carry this, didn't you? John asked. Yes. You know Casey Kay's my sponsor, right? John rolled his eyes. Who could forget when every time you open your mouth in a meeting you start with my sponsor Casey Kay always says. John, nobody loves a smartass. My wife does, he said. Because I'm a studly smartass. Dan sighed. Look in the book. John paged through it. These are the meetings from 2001. Casey told me I had to do 90 and 90 and keep track. Look at the 8th one. John found it. Fraser Methodist Church. A meeting he didn't often go to, but one he knew. Printed below the notation, in elaborate capital letters, was the word Abra.
John looked up at Dan, not quite unbelievingly.
She got in touch with you when she was 2 months old?
You see my next meeting just below it, Dan said, so I couldn't have added her name later just to impress you. Unless I faked the whole book, that is, and there are plenty of people in the program who'll remember seeing me with it.
Including me, John said.
Yeah, including you. In those days, I always had my meeting book in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. They were my security blankets. I didn't know who she was then, and I didn't much care. It was just one of those random touchings, the way a baby in a crib might reach out and brush your nose. Then 2 or 3 years later, she wrote a word on a scheduling blackboard I keep in my room. The word was, hello. She kept in contact after that, every once in a while, kind of touching base. I'm not even sure she was aware she was doing it, but I was there. When she needed help, I was the one she knew and the one she reached out to.
What kind of help does she need? What kind of trouble is she in? John turned to Billy. Do you know?
Billy shook his head. I never heard of her, and I hardly ever go to Anniston.
Who said Abra lives in Anniston?
Billy cocked a thumb at Dan.
He did.
Didn't he?
John turned back to Dan. All right. Say I'm convinced. Let's have the whole thing.
Dan told them about Abra's nightmare of the baseball boy. The shapes holding flashlights on him. The woman with the knife, the one who had licked the boy's blood off her palms. About how, much later, Abra had come across the boy's picture in the shopper. And she could do this why? Because the kid they killed was another one of these shiners. I'm pretty sure that's how the initial contact happened. He must have reached out while these people were torturing him. Abra has no doubt that's what they did, and that created a link.
One that continued even after the boy, this Brad Trevor, was dead?
I think her later point of contact may have been something the Trevor kid owned. His baseball glove. And she was able to link to his killers because one of them put it on. She doesn't know how she does it, and neither do I. All I know for sure is that she's immensely powerful.
The way you are.
Here's the thing, Dan said. These people, if they are people, are led by the woman who did the actual killing. On the day Abra came across the picture of Brad Trevor on a missing children page in the local rag, she got in this woman's head, and the woman got in Abra's. For a few seconds, they looked through each other's eyes. He held up his hands, made fists, and rotated them. Turn and turn about. Abra thinks they may come for her, and so do I, because she could be a danger to them.
There's more to it than that, isn't there?
Billy asked. Dan looked at him, waiting.
People who can do the shining thing have something, right? Something these people want. Something they can only get by killing.
Yes, John said. Does this woman know where Abra is? Abra doesn't think so, but you have to remember she's only 13. She could be wrong.
Does Abra know where the woman is?
All she knows is that when this contact, this mutual seeing, occurred, the woman was in a Sam's supermarket. That puts it somewhere out west, but there are Sam's in at least 9 states,
including Iowa.
Dan shook his head.
Then I don't see what we can accomplish by going there.
We can get the glove, Dan said. Abra thinks if she has the glove, she can link to the man who had it on his hand for a little while. She calls him Barry the Chunk. John sat with his head lowered, thinking. Dan let him do it.
All right, John said at last. This is crazy, but I'll buy it. Given what I know of Abra's history and given my own history with you, it's actually kind of hard not to. But if this woman doesn't know where Abra is, might it not be wiser to leave things alone? Don't kick a sleeping dog and all that?
I don't think this dog's asleep. Dan said,
these empty devils, freaks want her for the same reason they wanted the Trevor boy. I'm sure Billy's right about that. Also, they know she's a danger to them. To put it in AA terms, she has the power to break their anonymity. and they may have resources we can only guess at, would you want a patient of yours to live in fear month after month and maybe year after year, always expecting some sort of paranormal Manson family to show up and snatch her off the street? Of course not. These assholes live on children like her. Children like I was. Kids with The Shining. He stared grimly into John Dalton's face. If it's true, they need to be stopped.
Billy said, if I'm not going to Iowa, what am I supposed to do?
Let's put it this way, Dan said. You're going to get very familiar with Aniston in the week ahead. In fact, if Casey will give you time off, you're going to stay at a motel there.
5.
Rose finally entered the meditative state she had been seeking. The hardest thing to let go of had been her worries about Grandpa Flick, but she finally got past them, got above them. Now she cruised within herself, repeating the old phrases, Sabasahante, and Lord Samhante, and Kahana, Risone Hante, over and over again, her lips barely moving. It was too early to seek the troublesome girl, but now that she'd been left alone and the world was quiet both inside and out, she was in no hurry. Meditation for its own sake was a fine thing. Rose went about gathering her tools and focusing her concentration, working slowly and meticulously. Sabathahanti, Lord Samhanti, Kahana, Risone Hanti. Words that had been old when the True Knot moved across Europe in wagons, selling peat turfs and trinkets. They had probably been old when Babylon was young. The girl was powerful, but the True was all-powerful, and Rose anticipated no real problem. The girl would be asleep, and Rose would move with quiet stealth, picking up information and planting suggestions like small explosives. Not just one worm, but a whole nest of them. Some the girl might detect and disable, others not.
6.
Abra spoke with her mother on the phone for almost 45 minutes that night after she'd finished her homework. The conversation had two levels. On the top one, they talked about Abra's day, the school week ahead, and her costume for the upcoming Halloween dance. They discussed the ongoing plans to have Momo move north to the Fraser Hospice, which Abra still thought of as the hot spice. Lucy brought Abra up to date on Momo's condition, which she said was actually pretty good, all things considered. On another level, Abra listened to Lucy's nagging worry that she had somehow failed her grandmother, and to the truth of Momo's condition, frightened, addled, racked with pain. Abra tried to send her mother soothing thoughts. It's all right, Mom, and we love you, Mom, and you did the best you could for as long as you were able. She liked to believe that some of these thoughts got through, but didn't really believe it. She had many talents, the kind that were wonderful and scary at the same time, but changing another person's emotional temperature had never been one of them. Could Dan do that? She thought maybe he could. She thought he used that part of his shining to help people in the hot spice. If he could really do that, maybe he would help Momo when she got there. That would be good. She came downstairs wearing the pink flannel pajamas Momo had given her last Christmas. Her father was watching the Red Sox and drinking a glass of beer. She put a big smackaroo on his nose. He always said he hated that, but she knew he sort of liked it, and told him she was off to bed.
La homework est complete, mademoiselle?
Yes, Daddy. But the French word for homework is devoir.
Good to know, good to know.
How was your mother?
I asked because I only had about 90 seconds with her before you snatched the phone.
She's doing okay. Abra knew this was the truth, but she also knew okay was a relative term. She started for the hall, then turned back. She said Momo was like a glass ornament. She hadn't, not out loud, but she'd been thinking it. She says we all are. Dave muted the TV.
Well, I guess that's true, but some of us are made of surprisingly tough glass. Remember, your Momo's been up on the shelf safe and sound for many, many years. Now come over here, Abadou, and give your dad a hug. I don't know if you need it, but I could use one.
7. 20 minutes later, she was in bed with Mr. Pooh Bear Nightlight, a holdover from earliest childhood, glowing on the dresser. She reached for Dan and found him in an activities room where there were jigsaw puzzles, magazines, a ping-pong table, and a big TV on the wall. He was playing cards with a couple of Hot Spice residents.
Did you talk to Dr. John?
Yes, we're going to Iowa day after tomorrow. This thought was accompanied by a brief picture of an old biplane. Inside were two men wearing old-fashioned flying helmets, scarves, and goggles. It made Abra smile.
If we bring you...
Picture of a catcher's mitt. That wasn't what the baseball boy's glove really looked like, but Abra knew what Dan was trying to say.
Will you freak out?
No.
She better not. Holding the dead boy's glove would be terrible. But she would have to do it. 8. In the common room of Rivington 1, Mr. Braddock was staring at Dan with that look of monumental but slightly puzzled irritation which only the very old and borderline senile can bring off successfully.
Are you going to discard something, Danny, or just sit there staring into the corner until the ice caps melt?
Good night, Abra.
Good night, Dan. Say good night to Tony for me.
Danny?
Mr. Braddock knocked his swollen knuckles on the table.
Danny Torrance, come in. Danny Torrance, over.
Don't forget to set your alarm.
Hoo-hoo, Danny,
Cora Willingham said. Dan looked at them. Did I discard, or is it still my turn? Mr. Braddock rolled his eyes at Cora. Cora rolled hers right back.
And my daughters think I'm the one losing my marbles, she said.
9. Abra had set the alarm on her iPad because tomorrow was not only a school day, but one of her days to make breakfast. Scrambled eggs with mushrooms, peppers, and jack cheese was the plan. But that wasn't the alarm Dan had been talking about. She closed her eyes and concentrated, her brow furrowing. One hand crept out from under the covers and began wiping at her lips. What she was doing was tricky, but maybe it would be worth it. Alarms were all well and good, but if the woman in the hat came looking for her, a trap might be even better. After 5 minutes or so, the lines on her forehead smoothed out, and her hand fell away from her mouth. She rolled over on her side and pulled the duvet up to her chin. She was visualizing herself riding a white stallion in full warrior garb when she fell asleep. Mr. Pooh Bear Nightlight watched from his place on the dresser, as he had since Abra was 4, casting a dim radiance on her left cheek. That and her hair were the only parts of her that still showed. In her dreams, she galloped over long fields under 4 billion stars.
10.
Rose continued her meditations until 1:30 that Monday morning. The rest of the crew, with the exception of Apron Annie and Big Mo, currently watching over Grandpa Flick, were sleeping deeply when she decided she was ready. In one hand she held a picture, printed off her computer, of Anniston, New Hampshire's not very impressive downtown. In the other, she held one of the canisters. Although there was nothing left inside but the faintest whiff of steam, she had no doubt it would be enough. She put her fingers on the valve, preparing to loosen it.
We are the true knot, and we endure. Sabatha Hanti.
We are the chosen ones, Lodzum Hanti. We are the fortunate ones, Kahana Risone Hanti.
Take this and use it well, rosy girl, she said. When she turned the valve, a short sigh of silver mist escaped. She inhaled, fell back on her pillow, and let the canister drop to the carpet with a soft thud. She lifted the picture of Aniston's main street in front of her eyes. Her arm and hand were no longer precisely there, and so the picture seemed to float. Not far from that main street, a little girl lived down a lane that was probably called Richland Court. She would be fast asleep, but somewhere in her mind was Rose the Hat. She assumed the little girl didn't know what Rose the Hat looked like, any more than Rose knew what the girl looked like, at least not yet. But she knew what Rose the Hat felt like. Also, she knew what Rose had been looking at in Sam's yesterday. That was her marker, her way in. Rose stared at the picture of Aniston with fixed and dreaming eyes. But what she was really looking for was Sam's meat counter, where every cut is a blue ribbon cowboy cut. She was looking for herself, and after a gratifyingly short search, found her. At first, just an auditory trace, the sound of supermarket muzak. Then a shopping cart. Beyond it, all was still dark. That was all right. The rest would come. Rose followed the muzak, now echoing and distant. It was dark. It was dark. It was dark. Then a little light and a little more. Here was the supermarket aisle. Then it became a hallway. And she knew she was almost in. Her heartbeat kicked up a notch. Lying on her bed, she closed her eyes, so if the kid realized what was happening, unlikely but not impossible, she would see nothing. Rose took a few seconds to review her primary goals, name, exact location, extent of knowledge, anyone she might have told. Turn, world. She gathered her strength and pushed. This time, the sensation of revolving wasn't a surprise, but something she had planned for and over which she had complete control. For a moment, she was still in that hallway, the conduit between their two minds, and then she was in a large room where a little girl in pigtails was riding a bike and lilting a nonsense song. It was the little girl's dream, and Rose was watching it. But she had better things to do. The walls of the room weren't real walls, but file drawers. She could open them at will now that she was inside. The little girl was safely dreaming in Rose's head, dreaming she was 5 and riding her first bicycle. That was very fine. Dream on, little princess. The child rode past her singing la 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 and seeing nothing. There were training wheels on her bike, but they flickered on and off. Rose guessed the princess was dreaming of the day when she had finally learned to ride without them. Always a very fine day in a child's life. Enjoy your bicycle, dear, while I find out all about you. Moving with confidence, Rose opened one of the drawers. The instant she reached inside, an ear-splitting alarm began to bray, and brilliant white spotlights blazed on all around the room, beating down on her with heat as well as light. For the first time in a great many years, Rose the Hat, once Rose O'Hara from County Antrim in Northern Ireland, was caught completely off guard. Before she could pull her hand out of the drawer, it slammed shut. The pain was enormous. She screamed and jerked backward, but she was held fast. Her shadow jumped high on the wall, but not just hers. She turned her head and saw the little girl bearing down on her.
only she wasn't little anymore. Now she was a young woman wearing a leather jerkin with a dragon on her blooming chest and a blue band to hold back her hair. The bike had become a white stallion. Its eyes, like those of the warrior woman, were blazing. The warrior woman had a lance. You came back. Dan said you would, and you did. And then, unbelievable in a rube, even one loaded with big steam, pleasure. Good! The child who was no longer a child had been lying in wait for her. She had laid a trap. She meant to kill Rose. And considering Rose's state of mental vulnerability, she probably could. Summoning every bit of her strength, Rose fought back, not with some comic book lance, but with a blunt battering ram that had all her years and will behind it. Get away from me! Get the fuck back! No matter what you think you are, you're just a little girl! The girl's grown-up vision of herself, her avatar, kept coming. But she flinched as Rose's thought hit her, and the lance crashed into the wall of file drawers to Rose's immediate left instead of into her side, which was where it had been aimed. The kid, that's all she is, Rose kept telling herself, wheeled her horse away, and Rose turned to the drawer that had caught her. She braced her free hand above it and pulled with all her might, ignoring the pain. At first the drawer held, then it gave a little. She was able to pull out the heel of her hand. It was scraped and bleeding. Something else was happening. There was a fluttering sensation in her head as if a bird were flying around up there. What new shit was this? Expecting that goddamn lance to drive into her back at any moment, Rose yanked with all her might. Her hand slipped all the way out, and she curled her fingers into a fist just in time. If she'd waited even an instant, the drawer would have cut them off when it slammed shut. Her nails throbbed. And she knew when she had a chance to look at them, they would be plum-colored with trapped blood. She turned. The girl was gone. The room was empty. But that fluttering sensation continued. If anything, it had intensified. Suddenly the pain in her hand and wrist was the last thing on Rose's mind. She wasn't the only one who had ridden the turntable. And it didn't matter that her eyes were still shut back in the real world, where she lay on her double bed. The fucking brat was in another room filled with file drawers. Her room. Her head. Instead of the burglar, Rose had become the burgled. Get out, get out, get out, get out!